Welcome to the Capitol Press Room for Wednesday, June 1st. Like other municipalities across upstate New York, Tompkins County has been concerned about hydrofracking. So earlier this year, the county legislature commissioned a white paper on the economic impact of gas leases on property values. The report just came out yesterday. Today, we're going to hear from the guy who wrote the report, Greg May, who is the VP of Residential Mortgage Lending at Tompkins Trust Company. Plus, we'll get instant reaction from one of the legislators who wanted this report to be written, Carol Chalk. Then progressives were deeply disappointed when it became clear that President's health care reform plan wouldn't have a single-payer element in it. But the conversation is far from over. Today we're going to talk about the issue. Plus, it's busier today at the Capitol than it's been in a while. One of the events taking place around here is a rally against a proposed tax cap. More coming up on the show. Welcome back to the Capitol Press Room. Last week, you might remember a conversation we had with Assemblymember Barbara Lifton. She and a group of bankers had met with some members of the Cuomo administration a few weeks ago to alert them about a possible problem between mortgage lenders and property owners with gas leases. The concern was that gas leasing may somehow negatively impact property values. Lifton says she was looking forward to the release of a white paper on the issue that had been commissioned or something by a working group within the Tompkins County Legislature. Well, that white paper came out yesterday, and what it says can be useful for everyone involved in the hydrofracking debate. Today we're going to discuss the findings with two people, Carol Chalk, who represents portions of both the city and town of Ithaca on the Tompkins County Legislature, and Gregory May, who authored the report. May is a vice president of residential mortgage lending at Tompkins Trust Company. He's been in the mortgage lending business since 1971 and is active in mortgage banking, realtor, and building trade associations in upstate New York. So, Carol and Greg, welcome to the Capitol Press Room.
Thank you.
Hi, Susan. I'm honored to be here. I count on you to keep me up to date on the most important state issues.
Well, clearly I'm going to be nice to Carol. Kidding. So, Carol, listen, I was wondering if you could just give us a little bit of background. You chair a working group in the Tompkins County Legislature that looks at issues like assessments. How did it evolve that you needed a white paper?
Well, Susan, I hear from residents with concerns about all kinds of things related to gas drilling, environmental, industrial, truck traffic. But the work of the committee that brought us to this conversation was originally the concern that property tax rolls stay equitable as conditions change. You know my district has very high taxes, so we care that we balance our assessment rolls across our various neighborhoods regularly. The Tompkins County Council of Government's Task Force on Gas Drilling set up work groups to look at these different kinds of impacts, and I said I'd lead an effort, called together an assessment and land valuation group, looking at questions not environmental. Did we need to do anything related to gas drilling to make sure we could continue to keep the assessment rolls fair? Will assessments go up for people who have royalty money coming in? Will assessments go down if buyers are moving here for other reasons and don't want to purchase? Will people lose their agricultural exemptions? And will the county tax base go up due to this activity? That's what got me started on this.
So this is not about the environmental impact of hydrofracking. This is much more about property valuation and assessments. And have you heard from your constituents who are having problems in that regard?
Well, it was the concern that there would be problems in the future that led us to form this work group. And the concerns of several of our residents who had tried to find out where there were leases on properties that they were considering buying. So we then asked our assessment department and some other municipal officials, a town supervisor, some lawyers and residents to come and talk to us about whether what they were experiencing.
So how did you come upon Greg May, who is a lovely man, by the way?
Well, he certainly is, and he has been a pleasure to work with. Our whole group, by the way, has just been very professional and very thoughtful and deliberative as they have looked at these issues. We did not originally ask him to draft a white paper. We had really only asked him to come to one meeting and tell us that the rumors weren't true, that of course people could still get mortgages on leased property. Our committee first had looked at the issues that our appraisers and the market professionals and the director of our assessment department were having in finding out the information about which properties had leases and exactly what those leases say. You know, the assessment department needs that information for those assessment roles I talked about before that
sure.
they stay fair. The realtors need it to answer questions when they show properties. So we asked the president of the Ithaca Board of Realtors came, lovely woman named Rosemary Rocavina. Attorneys, title insurance companies need that information, and our appraisers need that information. Then we started hearing rumors that some banks, in particular the one that Greg May represents, were not making mortgages on leased property. And I thought, okay, that sounds alarmist. Let's ask them. So he was willing to come to talk to us. His counterpart, Bill Crane, the vice president at CFCU, which is a credit union, another lending institution, and the real estate attorney who works with several of our banks and lending institutions here, came to talk to us. And Greg really took it from there. The rest of us have gotten quite an education.
Okay, so Greg May, as we all know, no good deed goes unpunished. So he sort of stepped into this. What did the legislature specifically ask you to do? Like, what was in and not within the scope of your mission?
Actually, I was asked to focus purely on what impact, if any, there was on residential mortgage lending when there was a gas lease on the property. And I did start by putting together some notes on that, and one of the items that came out of it is the group appeared interested in learning more about some of the issues that we as lenders face. So I then put together a white paper, if you will, to actually assist in educating this working group on what the impacts are when there are gas leases on properties in our market area, and that's led to where we are today.
There is a lot that is not within the scope of your mission, and I just want to make sure that my listeners understand that.
Yeah, point well taken. This is not about environmental issues or health issues or whether or not there's no implied or expressed opinion on drilling in and of itself from my point of view. It is specifically focused on a very narrow section, which is residential mortgage lending. Now, Carol's group has a broader, a vision, if you will, or look at this operation and gas drilling in general, and there may be other issues that cross over. My piece is just on the residential mortgage piece.
So how did you undertake this research? Who did you speak to? What did they say?
I have been involved in the lending area for quite some time, residential lending, and reached out to counterparts at Fannie Mae, which is the agency that buys mortgages from banks across the country, Freddie Mac, again, another quasi-governmental agency that buys mortgages from banks across the country, banks and credit unions, lenders. I've reached out as well to Sunny Mae, State of New York Mortgage Agency, and I wanted to know what their positions were on mineral exploration, gas rights, oil rights, etc., on residential properties, and came to a conclusion that there was requirements that they've established, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, for an example, and Sunny Mae, State of New York Mortgage Agency, require at least a 200-foot setback from any residential property for any drilling operations or mineral mining operations of any sort. Now, that's not just the pad of drilling, but it's any horizontal drilling that takes place as well needs to be set back.
Let me just interrupt here. I apologize. I just want to make sure that I give listeners an overview, and then I want to come to you for the specifics.
Okay.
Tell us if this is right, that you've basically found three main concerns, all of which stem from New York's rules, regulations, and customs being slightly different from other states where fracking has already begun or takes place. There's a problem with the setback provision. There's a problem with the title. And there's an issue regarding assessing property values in the case of splitting mineral and surface rights. So back to the setback. What exactly is a setback, and what is New York's setback?
New York is looking right now and considering in their regulations a proposed setback or distance between the drill pad and a residential structure of 100 feet, where the secondary market, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Sannie Mae, State of New York Mortgage Agency, require at least a 200-foot setback. So there is a disconnect there. FHA, which is also included in my white paper, actually requires a 300-foot setback. So what we have found, the distance between a residential improvement and drilling operations would have to be at least 200 or potentially more, 300 for FHA financing, to meet those secondary market standards, those nationwide standards that have been established by these agencies.
So basically, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, the big mortgage lenders, sort of take their cues from these big the buyers of the mortgages, because eventually
Absolutely.
They want to buy those, they want to sell the mortgages to them.
Absolutely. All of us look, all of us as lenders across the country, I should say, look for the secondary market agencies, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA, NVA, to establish guidelines that we all tend to follow so that there is consistency in lending across multiple geographic areas.
All right. We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about the two other concerns that you have. And actually, first, we'll talk about how this particular concern could affect a landowner, and then the other two concerns. So Greg May is my guest, along with Carol Chalk, and we're talking about hydrofracking and gas leasing. We'll be right back after this short break.
Support for the Capital Press Room with Susan Arbetter comes from CSEA. Beginning a second century of service to all New Yorkers, every day 300,000 members provide the vital services families across the state depend on. And off the job, we volunteer, helping to make our communities even better places to live.
So we're going to go to Carol Chalk now to ask, how would these setbacks, the fact that New York only has a 100-foot setback, affect a property owner?
Okay, I'm a property owner, and I want to either sell or refinance my property to send my kids to college or build a new porch. And I go to my bank and want a mortgage or a refinance or a home equity line of credit. And the bank tells me, you now have a lease. We can't give you a mortgage, or we can only give you a mortgage at higher commercial rates. That may be a problem for me as a property owner. As more of these properties are leased, that becomes a problem also for the county, because we can't figure out where the leases are, and then for the market, for the whole market, because Greg, as the banker, gives me the mortgage, and then turns around and sells that mortgage to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in order to have more funding to give, you a mortgage next year. So that's why we think this is an issue not only for property owners individually, but for the market as a whole.
So the setback is one issue. The concern, too, has to do with the title of a property. And Carol or Greg, who wants to take this?
I'll take the title one.
Go ahead.
Title insurance is something that is commonly required in New York State and across the country. That ensures that there are no other claims against ownership of this property, no other liens, unpaid bank loans, or other owners who claim an interest in the property. Title insurance in New York State has some specific exclusions that would exclude or void coverage of title insurance. And those, the three that are most concerning are, one, any structure over 35 foot tall. The second, any transmission or storage of equipment or machinery or byproducts on the property. And three, any commercial use of the property other than a simple office in the home would frequently and typically void the insurance coverage, the title insurance coverage. Hence, it would not allow a lender to be able to participate in selling loans through the secondary market.
So basically, if there's a gas lease or some kind of gas drilling that's being undertaken on a property, the title would not be accepted by a mortgage lender.
Or could cause some level of concern if the title insurance, which it has exclusions, specifically voids the coverage because of the commercial operation on the property.
Gotcha. So we're talking now about things that could cause a possible pain in the tush for anybody who has this. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, that is absolutely correct. It would complicate the issue if there was not the ability to secure title insurance that was enforceable or that was voided because of the operation, then that could in fact negatively impact the ability to get traditional mortgage financing. As Carol mentioned, there may be some other options, but they may not be as competitive or as frequently available in certain markets, and that's the concern.
Okay. Now, the final concern, the big concern that you have, has to do with basically what Carol's entire working group is focused on, and that is how properties are valued and assessed in New York. In other words, how do you know how much something is worth? And New York doesn't have a history of splitting up rights, surface rights and mineral rights. So it's hard to estimate what the value of a property is.
That's correct. Residential real estate is valued by comparing it to similar properties that have sold within a reasonably short period of time and small distance. Let's say for argument's sake, within 6 months to a year, and within 1 mile. It's very difficult for two reasons to establish value. Number one is that the gas companies frequently don't immediately record leases, so there's no public way for us to find those as lenders or appraisers. And then number two, some of the leases might give away surface rights as well as below surface rights. Some may just give away below surface rights. Some may not give either away, but just allow someone to cross on their property. So it's very difficult to compare apples to apples and establish value. And it's not common. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
It's not common in New York State to split off low surface rights from surface rights. It is common that you're buying both surface rights and right below the property, or mineral rights, if you will. You're buying a wedge of property that goes, in theory, to the center of the earth.
So, Greg, won't time and experience sort this last concern out? I mean, the more this happens, then the more you'll be able to refer to other properties.
That is correct. As time goes on, and if there are splitting of below and above surface rights, there will be some history developed. It will take several years, most likely, to get all of the, to get some history so you can start making educated decisions on whether or not you're comparing a similar property. My property may not have mineral rights below it, and Carol's may have mineral rights, and there's, we're trying to determine, is there a difference in value for a potential buyer coming to buy, and that right now we don't have a history of.
All right. So I know that I asked this before, but I just want to make sure. Have either of you heard from either banks or property owners in general about issues surrounding mortgages, either banks hesitating to issue a mortgage or charging a higher interest rate when it comes to property with gas leases?
Many of the lenders that I talk to across our region are in the same situation with the setback, the distance, the title insurance, and the valuation, where they have some hesitancy. There is some concern on whether or not they can grant a residential mortgage in a traditional sense. Where many of the lenders that I've talked to are trying to work around that by asking the gas companies to release certain portions of land so that we can, in fact, stabilize and offer a traditional mortgage.
Carol?
Susan, I hear from both people who've tried to sell properties and have had sales fall through and from the banks that and lenders that they used to be able to, even as recently as 18 months ago, call the gas companies and have the required 200 feet setback cleared around the property, and that the gas companies are no longer willing to do that.
Why is that?
We do hear that there's a current concern. Well, we can only surmise that they are trying to amass those 640-acre spacing units that they anticipate will be that they'll be permitted to assemble. But
so,
my,
Carol,
my biggest
we only have 30 seconds, okay, but
right.
I need to know what your next step is.
Okay. New York State really needs to look at this. My little committee with five meetings and one trip to Albany has amassed a list of problems and requests that might fix this problem immediately. The concern is that the DEC is only being asked to look at the environmental concerns. There's a whole host that is not of problems and issues, economic, that aren't going to be solved in the next few weeks while the legislature's in session. This needs a real look by professionals, by the agencies that know their own work, by Sunny May, by the economic development team.
Carol and Greg, can you hold on for another 30 seconds?
Sure.
Sure.
Okay, hold on. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Support for the Capitol Press Room with Susan Arbetter is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of more than 600,000 professionals in education and healthcare.
Welcome back. We are going to extend our segment about hydrofracking and gas leasing with Carol Chalk of the Tompkins County Legislature and Greg May of who basically wrote this white paper, who is the Vice President of Residential Mortgage Lending at Tompkins Trust Company. So knowing, Carol, that the SGEIS and the DEC, their purview is exclusively the environment. Who needs to do sort of the financial SGEIS, let's say? Who would you like to see? Is that even a possibility?
Well, again, we've only found maybe the tip of the iceberg, and we're hearing conflicting things. On the one hand, the Deputy Secretary for Economic Development has taken an interest. And we have senators in the Housing and Finance Committees, their staffs. Assembly members, Barbara Lifton has taken the lead, the Assembly Energy and Banking Committees. We believe that Sunny Mae, ORPTS, the Office of Real Property Tax Services, the DEC, maybe the people who oversee meters, which might be the PSC, we're not sure. We need to make sure that landowners get the proper royalty check, that we know what the size of that is for the tax assessment rolls. We believe that it isn't possible to do that in a few weeks, and whether it's done through the ESGEIS, which I don't see how you can issue permits without knowing the answers to some of these questions. You don't need an environmental perspective to understand that we need the answers to these. You can be pro-drilling and think we need the answers to these questions. Whether it's the DEC or whether it's somebody else before the DEC comes out with their final regulations, we'd like all of those agencies to be asked to take a look, as well as the legislature to have a chance and the governor's office to look more seriously at these questions. And it can't be done by July 1st, as the governor is now calling for.
So, Greg May, final word from you. As someone who works in this industry, is this concerning? I mean, what are you going to do when, you know, they say go with the hydrofracking?
We're going to continue to do our best to ask gas companies to release surface rights and subsurface rights, below ground rights, so that we can offer traditional financing under the terms that are established in the secondary market. We're hopeful that the state and will in fact establish setbacks like other states do that would be in excess of the minimum required. And many states across the United States have far greater setbacks than 100 feet. And I think that's a step in the right direction if New York State would at least consider doing something along those lines.
Pennsylvania, for example, does not have compulsory integration. It's something that they call forced pooling. And this could be one of the reasons why Pennsylvania is not having a problem with the gas companies releasing the surface rights and the mineral rights.
And Pennsylvania has a minimum of 200 feet setback, is my understanding. So we're already they're already a step ahead because there are further away. It seems to line up more closely with secondary requirements.
Well, I want to thank you both. I know this is a very complicated issue, and lots of emotions sort of bolster the issue from both sides. Carol Chalk is a Tompkins County legislator, and Greg May is the vice president of residential mortgage lending at Tompkins Trust Company. He's also the author of a white paper. Carol, is there someplace online where this white paper is kept that, you know, the regular folks like who are listening can read it?
Well, our work group has a website. If you go to, if you search for Tompkins County Council of Governments, and then click around till you get to the assessment and land valuation work group, we will post it there. We've posted my letter to the governor as we first discovered these questions that included that paper, and a list of specific requests that we have given to the governor and to other folks in Albany, things that can be satisfied more immediately, and things that we think need further consideration as they move forward.
Well, I think maybe we'll talk later about
it. I can give you the link. I can send you the link.
Why don't you send me the link and we can put it on our website?
Okay.
Does that sound all right? Well, we can talk about this off the air,
fine.
But at any rate, I want to thank you very much. Tompkins County Legislator Carol Chalk, Vice President of Residential Mortgage Lending at Tompkins County Trust Company, Gregory May. I appreciate it. I'm sure we'll talk again.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So now we're going to turn our attention to single payer. if they were starring in a Monty Python movie, I think single payer might say, I'm not dead yet. Vermont did it, or is doing it, so now advocates for single-payer health care want to introduce a bill to do the same thing here in New York. Here to discuss the pros and cons of this is Dr. Garrett Adams. He's the president of Physicians for a National Health Program and a pediatrician from Louisville. Welcome to the Capitol Press Room.
Thank you, Susan.
That's a great accent.
Oh, already? Just two words
well,
and it
please.
Was an accent?
It's fabulous, let me tell you. You are in town to do rounds?
Yes, we had
Med?
pediatric grand rounds at the medical college this morning.
What does that mean?
Well, it's a time when the specialists in whatever group get together and discuss things of moment. In the old days, it was always centered around patients who would actually bring a patient into an amphitheater and discuss the findings and the treatment and learn from the case. But now it's morphed into more of a topical discussion where the presentation, I made a presentation about the healthcare, what'd they call it?
I always forget the show that I did yesterday.
It's
hard to remember.
The
doesn't matter.
Well, doesn't matter, but
doesn't
it was about the single payer national health reform, national health insurance.
Oh, so it was on the topic that we're talking about today.
Right.
How did you become an advocate for single payer?
Well, Susan, I read an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2003. That caught my attention. That was the title. The physician's proposal, healthcare for everyone, and it was called a national health plan. And it was so incredibly reasonable that I wasted no time in going to the site pnhp.org. PNHP stands for Physicians for a National Health Program.org, and I endorsed the program. And when they had an annual meeting and a leadership conference, I went to the leadership conference and the annual meeting, and I met a lot of wonderful people, such as Dr. Andy Coates from Albany here, and Dr. Paul Sorum, also from Albany, and from all over the country. And then continued with that activity and just enjoyed the association so much. And I think it's such a worthwhile endeavor.
Why? I mean, there's a lot of obviously this is a debate that we've been having publicly in this country for 10 years, more than that, since 95, 94. There are a lot of myths surrounding single payer. What do and physicians, by the way, aren't always the most progressive when it comes to healthcare reform. Can you tell us, just in a nutshell, what is single payer, and why is it that your group supports it, and does your group represent physicians?
I'm going to take the last part of your question first. We do represent physicians. There was a recent. There are 18,000 of us now, all volunteer. And there was a random survey of physicians. The survey database was drawn from the AMA membership records. And this survey was performed by Dr. Carroll from Indiana University School of Medicine. And there were 5,000 randomly chosen physicians, and they made the survey in 2003 maybe, and then again 5 years later, 2006, or maybe it was 2001, and then again in 2006. In the first study, 49% of the polled physicians indicated that they supported a government insulated or government supported national health program. 5 years later, 2006, it was 59%. In some specialties, for example, I'm a subspecialist in pediatrics. Pediatric subspecialists support the program 83%.
So basically, as healthcare becomes more expensive and the problems become more obvious, more physicians are supporting single payer. Is that accurate?
It is inaccurate to the extent that we consider invasive or intervention or procedure-oriented physicians. Procedure-oriented physicians are less interested. Primary care doctors such as myself and internists, obstetricians, psychiatry are great supporters. But the problem is that people are hurting, and you don't have to go far to find a person who has been injured and who is suffering because of the lack of a unified health system and in this country. I'm sure that if you talk to the first five people that you meet when you walk out this door today, if you could, you would find a healthcare horror story where they've been could not afford medicine, could not afford to go to the doctor, they have diabetes. The emergency room physicians are telling us that they are seeing – emergency room physicians, by the way, are strong supporters, and we have many of them in our organization.
Let me just go back real quick. Mm-hmm. You did mention that those physicians who are sort of procedure-oriented.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
They are actually not as supportive of single-payer as physicians like
the
yourself.
Primary care.
Okay.
Right.
So why would that be?
Well, I think they might see that it would – infringe on their income. It would infringe on the income.
Okay. So that was two parts of the question pretty much. What is single payer? What is it that you like about it that would help your patients? Or just tell us you like about it.
Basically what it does is it will provide comprehensive care to everyone in the country.
Can we afford that now?
We can't afford not to do it because the health insurance industry is really wrecking the health system here. We lose 30% of every health care dollar in this country because of the desire, I want to call it greed. It's too strong a word, but still, because of the commercialization, let me say, of healthcare, we have to come to a point in this country where we say that healthcare is a right and it should not be monetized or corporatized. That's what's ruining the healthcare system in this country.
Dr. Adams, we're going to have to take a break in a second, but hopefully you'll stay for a couple more minutes. We're talking with Dr. Garrett Adams. He's the president of Physicians for a National Health Program. He's also a pediatrician from Louisville, Kentucky, and he was up here speaking with Albany Medical College doing grand rounds basically about this very issue. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the challenges that people who advocate for single payer face when they try to push and advocate for that particular initiative. We'll be right back after this short break.
Support for the Capital Press Room with Susan Arbetter comes from CSEA. Beginning a second century of service to all New Yorkers, every day 300,000 members provide the vital services families across the state depend on. And off the job, we volunteer, helping to make our communities even better places to live.
There was a report in the New York Times over the weekend that was fascinating. It was about doctors in Maine who used to be sort of on the right side politically of the spectrum over political issues, and as they give away their own practices to start working for hospitals, their political leanings have shifted over to the left. I thought that was interesting, and more of them are now considering single-payer health care. But again, back to the cost. How is Vermont going to do it?
Well, that remains to be seen, but the most dramatic impact from the legislation that Governor Shumlin signed, Governor Peter Shumlin signed on May the 26th, was that the state of Vermont and the Vermont people, legislature, and the governor made a public statement that health care for everyone is a right, and that they want to provide that to every citizen, that they will have a unified health system. That's a dramatic statement. It's never been made before in this country, and they did that. And it comes from the grassroots. It comes from the people who elected the legislators, the individual representatives and senators and Governor Shumlin, and they ran on this program, and they call it a single-payer program. It's not everything that they would like it to be, but they've done that. And there were 200 medical students that we organized from around the country who came to and from local, most of them were regional, came to Vermont to tell the governor and Senator Bernie Sanders that this is what we need to do. And there were that many physicians who said we would locate our practices, we would leave. There's one in Kentucky who said, if Vermont enacted a single-payer plan, I would consider leaving Kentucky to get away from the harassment from the insurance companies and this market-based system. I would go where we have a single-payer system. And there were some 200 physicians that said they would do that.
As we know, Vermont is a great place, a special place, a place that doesn't have some of the big problems that a larger state like New York has. However, there is a move in New York to push a bill mm-hmm. for single payer, mm-hmm. and they're going to be doing that, I believe, next week. I'm not mm-hmm. sure which day.
Mm-hmm. Do you? I think it's the 7th.
The 7th. Oh, okay. So it's what, next Tuesday, there's going to be mm-hmm. An announcement mm-hmm. among some of mm-hmm. the groups like Citizen Action.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Gottfried will present the bill.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. So Assemblyman Gottfried, who's mm-hmm. the chairman of the Health Committee, is going mm-hmm. to be presenting it. Mm-hmm. We're out of time, unfortunately, mm-hmm. but I hope you enjoy your time here in Albany.
Thanks.
Make Albany Med take you to Quintessence. They have great food. Dr. Garrett Adams, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you.
The Capitol Press Room.
Welcome back. I don't know how it happened, but today is sort of like Tompkins County Day on the roundtable. But we love Tompkins County. It's beautiful. It's gorgeous.
That's right.
So Martha Robertson is here, and she is the president or the chair of the Tompkins County Legislature, and has been on the legislature since 2002. Now, you chair the Tompkins County Industrial Development Agency. You are somebody who is integrally, intimately, I should say, familiar with all the different workings of why a tax cap would be good or bad. You say it's going to be bad. You say it's sound bite, not sound policy. Why?
Absolutely. Because every legislator and the governor, they all know that the reason that property taxes are high in New York is because of state mandates. 90% of the levies, the total levy charged by counties for property taxes goes directly to state mandates. These aren't excuses.
We've heard about this. We've heard about this from so many people. I mean, certainly counties, cities, mayors. We've heard about it over and over again. Yet they don't seem to be listening. Why?
Because it would be hard. Mandate relief would be hard.
Relief would be hard. I'm putting that on a sign somewhere around here. Mandate relief would be hard.
Would be hard. There are basically two ways to do it. The state has to either pay its own bills, take responsibility, be accountable for its programs, indigent defense, preschool preschool special ed, safety net, child welfare, TANF, probation, Medicaid, you know, 9 big mandates that counties, these are actual bills we have to pay. This is not about details of how we negotiate contracts. This is, you know, they send us the bill, we pay the bill.
The money that you have to pay, that property taxes go to, have to pay for this stuff. 90% goes to that stuff.
Exactly.
And you have no control over it.
No control. So the state would either have to pick up those costs or decide that those programs, you know, we're going to cut back the programs themselves. Both of those are hard to do. We believe, however, like you know, every other state manages to have the state pay the share of Medicaid instead of the counties. NYSEC, Association of Counties, has a proposal that they better start taking over Medicaid, use resources from the Affordable Care Act that are coming in next year. They can do this. Start taking over Medicaid. That would property taxes would drop like a stone, not be capped at 2% growth.
You're the first person to come in here with an actual solution that might be politically viable. Because they're thinking about taking over Medicaid because of the Affordable Care Act.
And they should.
There are, unfortunately, you say, new cost shifts in the governor's budget that make this tax cap even more painful.
That's right. About for Tompkins County, about $850,000 of cuts to programs we have to still provide. As I said, probation, child welfare, Medicaid. Those are cuts in the reimbursements we get. We still have to do the programs. That more than eats up the 2% tax cap right there. Then there's growth in Medicaid, growth in other expenses, other mandates, and growth in the pensions, which this year is a real biggie. And by the way, that the sort of carve-out for pensions,
which is very complicated.
It's complicated, and it's not a 2% carve-out. It's a 2% on the rate, so it's hardly going to help us.
It's something that might help for the next few years, but hasn't helped in the past, only a few times. But that even that carve-out is not being sort of digested well by certain upstate Republican assembly people and senators. So I'm not sure. Would you rather have the status quo?
Does that mean as it is right now with no cap?
Yes.
Actually, I would say yes, because then we could work on mandate relief in tandem at the same time as working on controlling property taxes. That's what we were promised. The governor looked me in the eye when he was a candidate in Ithaca in August. He said, oh, we'd never do a tax cap without mandate relief. Well, that's what they're doing. So every one of them has said that.
Well, if he was here right now, what would you say to him?
Governor, you broke your promise. You said we're opposed to the tax cap because it limits our power. We don't have the power, Governor. You do, and that's, you know, this is the worst it's ever been. The counties are being blamed. And by the way, you know, the school budgets almost all passed. So I don't know. I'm not sure what the issue is here. But it's certainly a good bumper sticker slogan and lousy policy.
And that bumper sticker would be it's good sound bite, but not sound policy.
That's right.
So you're here along with a lot of other groups in order to make sure that your voice is heard. What else are you pushing, and what is your plan of action today?
Well, one of the other ideas is the counties have to get state permission to do. There are 5 different local revenues. There's a 1% on the sales tax. There's mortgage recording tax, transfer tax, some small taxes that we need state authority to levy those. So we have to come hat in hand and beg them, and they hold back, and you know, and
they,
and
what
now
do you mean they hold back?
They don't vote on them till the last day or two of session.
Yeah.
It's a political card that
yep.
leadership plays. So we feel like we have no tools. So at least we're proposing, and NYSEC is looking at this. They said, go ahead and push it, Martha. We're proposing a permanent threshold on 5 levies. And, you know, just give us the permission, blanket, not that we would raise those taxes automatically, but give counties the flexibility, give them the authority at this point without begging Albany. And then if mandate relief comes through, we won't have to raise those taxes.
So you want a permanent threshold on 5 levies. Tell us specifically which 5.
Sales tax. It's current. The threshold's now 3%, and since 1992, we've been getting, you know, every other year we get permission to go to 4%. 50 counties now have 4%. So every other year we have to come begging for permission. So sales tax, mortgage recording tax, deed transfer tax, those are two taxes when you get out a mortgage. One is on the payer and one is on the buyer. Landline telephone surcharge and wireless telephone surcharges, those are important because the state had said, do you remember statewide wireless network? I don't know. This was the emergency communications system. The state was going to build out this great communication system for the localities so we'd have more seamless network. This was after 9/11, big idea. It fell apart. They went with the wrong vendor. It crashed and burned. We are now buying and maintaining those emergency communication services. At least give us the option to raise those telephone surcharges if we have to pay those costs.
Okay, so basically you're here to ask the legislature for the counties want the ability to raise these particular taxes on their own.
If they want to, without begging.
Okay, and that's because of the cost shifting.
Right.
It's like, you know, asking Peter to pay Paul.
Right.
Or having England sell France's colonies. All right. If people want more information, is there a place that you can recommend that they go? I mean, is it the NYSAC website?
This idea about the threshold,
yes,
has not been vetted. We really pulled it out because when we saw the assembly make a deal with the governor, we went, oh dear, this is really going to happen with no help for us. So we're going to pull this out. Tompkins County is floating this. If somebody wants it, then they can contact Tompkins County.
Martha Robertson is the chair of the Tompkins County Legislature. Thank you very much for joining
me. My pleasure.
Coming up tomorrow, Daryl Aubertine. This is the Capital Press Room.
Support for the Capital Press Room with Susan Arbetter is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of more than 600,000 professionals in education and healthcare. This program is presented by WCNY Syracuse. Join us again for the Capital Press Room.